This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The U.S. state of California is a few days away from coming under tighter restrictions as intensive care units reach near capacity levels with the latest surge in the coronavirus cases. Governor Gavin Newsom said on Thursday regional stay-at-home orders would likely go into effect in the next day or two in places with less than 15% ICU availability. Newsom said if he did not act now, the hospital system will be overwhelmed. Each of the state's five regions will separately activate the governor's order, which also bans private gatherings and requires masks and social distancing in public places. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, joining three other living former presidents in encouraging Americans to get a COVID-19 vaccination shot as soon as it becomes available. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporting that Carter's office did not confirm whether he planned to get the vaccine. Carter is 96 years old. Also Thursday, former President Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama all agreed to get vaccinated on camera to help instill confidence in Americans to get the injection. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the U.S. top infectious disease expert, also said he would be willing to be vaccinated on camera. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control vaccine advisors are recommending that healthcare workers and residents of long-term facilities be first in line for any coronavirus vaccines that get emergency authorization, that is, from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Via remote, this is VOA News. Facebook announced it will begin removing false claims about COVID-19 vaccines from its social media platform as part of an ongoing campaign to combat the spread of misinformation about them. The social media giant said it will begin removing information about the vaccines that has been discredited by public health experts in the coming weeks. The decision, which also applies to Instagram, comes as the first COVID-19 vaccines are about to become available. Britain may start vaccinations within days after becoming the first country to give emergency authorization for a vaccine developed by U.S. drug maker Pfizer and Germany's BioNTech. Facebook has taken similar steps in recent months, removing 12 million posts with coronavirus misinformation from March to October, including a video post from President Donald Trump declaring that children are virtually immune to the coronavirus. The UN Secretary General said Thursday the damage COVID-19 has done globally will not be undone by a vaccine, and a full recovery will take years, if not decades. Antonio Guterres was speaking to a high-level special session of the General Assembly intended to take stock of the current global response to the illness caused by the coronavirus. Guterres says, in his words, we face the biggest global recession in 8 decades. These intergenerational impacts are not due to COVID-19 alone. They are the result of long-term injustices that have been exposed by the pandemic. Nearly 80 heads of state and government and officials are addressing the 2-day summit by video, which will include presentations from scientists, experts, and the head of several UN agencies. An official installed by the Trump administration as a liaison at the Justice Department has been banned from the building. Three other people familiar with the matter told the Associated Press Heidi Stirrup was told within the last 2 weeks to vacate the building after top Justice Department officials learned she was trying to collect insider information about ongoing cases and department work on election fraud. Stirrup, a top ally of Trump advisor Stephen Miller, had been quietly installed at the Justice Department as a White House liaison a few months ago. And Hong Kong media tycoon and pro-democracy advocate Jimmy Lai was denied bail after being charged with fraud Thursday in a Hong Kong court. For more information, we invite you to join us at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ghana to beef up security for Monday's general elections.
We plan to deploy over 62,000 security personnel, and that means that it's not just the police service, but police officers and officers from other security agencies.
Stacey Nutt in Accra will have an election preview. Cameroon separatists call for a stay at home for Sunday's regional election. Kenyan university students protest tuition hike. And a former Liberian rebel commander is on trial in Switzerland.
The trial of Ali Khosa represents a great opportunity for victims and survivors of civil war. And I think it may open the eyes of the Liberian government, hopefully, that they too will begin to look at the issue of impunity.
And hundreds of thousands are displaced by Mozambique's Islamist insurgency. The stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ghanaians go to the polls Monday with incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo and former President John Mahama as frontrunners. Akufo-Addo's party has campaigned mainly on his education initiatives, while Mahama's has focused on job creation and attacking his opponent's record on corruption. But as Stacey Nutt reports from Accra, the familiar faces have also made voter apathy an issue.
Ghana's government this week announced Monday, December 7th, would be a public holiday to help get voters to the polls to choose the next president. Despite more than 17 million registered voters and 12 presidential candidates, authorities are battling voter apathy with familiar frontrunners from the last two elections. Incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party, NPP, is facing off against his predecessor, John Mahama, of the opposition National Democratic Congress, NDC. Mahama won in the 2012 election and then lost to Akufo-Addo in the 2016 election. Kodjo Asante is with the Ghana Centre for Democratic Development. He says there is fatigue, mainly among the middle classes.
The first few hours is always a good indicator of whether people will eventually go out. If they see that the crowds are behaving and then they get feedback that, oh, it's very easy to go and vote and so on, people might eventually still go out, even if they have decided not to.
Despite the challenge, Asante says their pre-election survey shows Ghanaians are concerned about issues such as improving infrastructure and employment. The survey pointed to positive responses on the ruling NPP's handling of COVID-19, power supplies and education. But the public was less impressed with Akufo-Addo's record on inflation, inequality and corruption. Attacking Akufo-Addo on corruption was a focus of Mahama's campaign, along with job creation. But risk consultancy group Songhai Advisory's Kobi Annan says both men have underperformed in office.
It's a difficult choice for a lot of people. Neither of them have performed fantastically during their terms in office. Yeah, I think it will come down to primarily sentiments around things like education, corruption, job creation, and education in particular. Those affect more people than day-to-day than corruption does.
Under Mahama's presidency, there was an energy crisis, corruption scandals and a currency devaluation. In 2016, the NPP won by about 1 million votes and with high expectations for Akufo-Addo to stamp out corruption. But in the weeks leading up to this year's election, the opposition NDC made corruption allegations against Akufo-Addo. Ghana's anti-corruption special prosecutor resigned just 3 weeks before the election, alleging political interference. While Akufo-Addo denies any corruption in his administration, analysts say it's hard to know if the claims will impact the vote. Regardless of the result or voter turnout, analysts are expecting Ghana's election to be fair and peaceful, as with the last two elections. Stacey Nott for VOA News, Accra.
Ghanaian police say they plan to deploy officers across the country for Monday's presidential and parliamentary elections. They say they will be supported by other security agencies, including the army, to maintain law and order, prevent intimidation, and ensure the public feels safe to vote. This following a recent survey that showed that prospective voters would like to have an armed police officers at the polling stations. Sheila Kese Abeye-Buckman, spokesperson for the Ghanaian police, tells viewers Peter Clotty that they have implemented new measures to keep the peace and ensure the safety of voters.
Sufficient preparations have been made. You know, we plan to deploy over 62,000 security personnel. And that means that it's not just the police service, but police officers and officers from other security agencies. I mean, the Ghana Immigration Service is one, the Ghana Fire Service is one, the Ghana Prison Service is one, Customs Division of the Ghana Revenue Authority, and we will also be supported by the Ghana Armed Forces. All these officers have been deployed, and particularly on election day, you see us in our numbers providing security before, during, and after 7th December.
So talk to me about this. Some surveys that were done showed that some prospective voters will feel more comfortable if there is an armed security officer at the polling station when they go to the polls, because they express concern about some vigilante groups or individuals who might try to cause trouble and all that. How are the police planning to assure Ghanaians about protection, about security during the elections?
So we are aware of this survey, but the good news is that we are on the ground. There is a police station at every corner in this country. And that is why the District Election Security Task Force work has been very good. We engage with the community. In fact, what we do is community policing. So we know what the various communities expect and need. And so the plan generally is that the officer at the polling station will not be armed. But we have three more tiers of officers who will be armed, because we are deploying four tier of officers for the election, and particularly on election day, the period for collation, the period before declaration, and during the declaration and jubilation.
Okay, talk to me about public engagement in circumstances where a prospective voter, a voter in queue will say, okay, I suspect this person trying to create confusion or trying to undermine the integrity of the election. When they approach the police, or if they don't, they express concern. Have you trained the police officers to handle such situations?
Of course we have. You know, the good thing for us this year is that we had to undertake some kind of humanitarian policing during the COVID lockdown in some areas of the country. And that gave us a lot of experience and exposure on how to handle these matters. Because, you know, COVID is a public health matter. So we didn't have to approach it the usual police manner, which meant that we needed to speak to people to wear their masks, to stay home, to wash their hands, to keep social distancing. That has been very useful for election as well. So our officers on the ground, be it a police officer, be it any officer from the institution spoken about, have been sufficiently trained and psyched to engage civilians in a manner that civilians will feel confident and comfortable.
Last but certainly not the least, what is the message of the Ghanaian police everybody?
Great. Our message is that we are deeply committed to ensuring peace. We are deeply committed to prevent crimes from happening. But when they do, we are also very ready to arrest the perpetrators, to go through the consequence of the law. So Ghanaians should feel very confident in the police. They do not have to go to the polls and be wondering or be concerned about their security. That is why the Election Security Task Force was formed, not only with the police service, but we needed the numbers and the resources of other security agencies for this work. Ghana will be peaceful. Just do your bit. On election day, you wear your mask, you wear clothing that has no party colors. You go to the polls, you go to the polling station, make sure you stand in the queue with some amount of distance, you follow the protocols. After voting, you go home. You can monitor all media houses for updates. During collation and counting time, you can go back to the polling station, just help in the counting and collation. And then Ghana will be peaceful. We are there for you. We will give the necessary protection.
Sheila Kese Abeye-Buckman is the spokesperson for the Ghanaian police. She spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty on assignment in Accra, Ghana. Cameroon separatists have called for a stay at home in the country's English-speaking regions for Sunday's regional election. The separatists have been fighting the Cameroon government for independence of the English-speaking regions. The Cameroon government says Sunday's elections will bring about decentralization and give the regions greater say over spending and local government. Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia.
We, the people of the Southern Cameroons, Ambazonia, have since 2017 severed every form of political relations with the Republic of Cameroon, and we have since banned any elections organized by Yaounde in our territory, and this coming election scheduled for the weekend means absolutely nothing to us, and we have told our people to stay home and not participate in the fraudulent election.
But the government of Cameroon says the election will give the regions more freedom in how they run their own affairs.
Not at all, James. These elections are not giving the people of the Southern Cameroons any freedom or power to run their own affairs. At the end of this election, the people will still not have the power to elect their governors. The people will still not have the power to elect their mayors. The people will still not have the power to run their own schools and run their own police departments. The people will still not have the power to run their own hospitals. The people will still not have the power to initiate development projects for their own communities. That is the reason why we are calling this window dressing. I mean, it's worse than window dressing. It is actually meant to divide and conquer all of the Southern Cameroon. The Southern Cameroons had only one House of Representatives. This time, their election is creating two Houses of Representatives, one in the Northern Zone, one in the Southern Zone, whereas there was only one. They are also creating a House of Chiefs, one in the Northern Zone, one in the Southern Zone. And the goal is to divide us and conquer us.
How do you intend to disrupt the election if that is the case?
We do not intend to disrupt the elections. We have merely asked our people to stay home so that we do not legitimize or dignify the fraud and the sham that is being organized from Yaounde. We have equally, as you know, decreed a four-day lockdown, that is Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. We are doing this to send a message to the international community that Ambazonians are not participating in French Cameroon elections. That's the message.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia. You are speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 4th. The trial of former Liberian rebel commander Aliou Kossia enters its second day today, Friday, in Switzerland. He is accused of killing or participating in the killing of 18 civilians, forced a displaced woman to be his wife, raping her repeatedly, and recruiting a 12-year-old boy as his personal bodyguard. Rodney Sie, publisher and editor of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper, was in the courtroom on Thursday in Bellinzona, Switzerland.
The detailed indictment, which we've been privy to, accuses Kossia of recruitment and use of child soldiers, forced transportation, looting, cruel treatment of civilians, attempted murder, and desecration of corpses and rape. All these are tied to an incident in June 2003 called Black Monday, which took place in Foya Lofa County in northern Liberia. Kossia was then a senior ranking member of the United Liberation Movement for Democracy, ULIMO, and he, according to eyewitnesses who are being used to build this case against him, he was a key figure in that Black Monday attack.
I was reading your article for today, Friday, in which you talk about a witness dilemma in this case. Exactly what do you mean?
Well, most of the witnesses, including the seven witnesses on whose testimony the case is being built, are not in court. Because of the deadly coronavirus pandemic, the Swiss authorities have been reluctant to provide visas for these witnesses to come to Switzerland. So the argument from the lawyers of the plaintiff is that you cannot build a case against someone like Sosia without the witnesses being in court. And as I speak to you, there are attempts to have some video conferencing of witnesses from Liberia watching Sosia testify. He may testify today or he may testify on Monday. Based on the speed at which the first day went, the lawyers on both sides told me on Thursday, yesterday, that he may testify today.
Rodney, how do you think Mr. Kosia's case is playing in Liberia? After all, you know very well that there are some people who took part in the Liberian Civil War who have served or are serving in the Liberian government.
Well, James, as you know, it's been 10 years after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission made its recommendation for the establishment of a war crimes court in Liberia. But yet, Liberia, Africa's oldest republic, is yet to prosecute any of its alleged criminals for war crimes. All of the cases so far have been tried outside Liberia. Today, we see former warlords retain positions of power and witnesses are reluctant to come forward because of that. The trial of Ali Kwasa represents a rare opportunity for victims and survivors of the Civil War to see one of the most feared warlords of the Civil War standing trial. I think for Liberians, this case represents a clear opportunity for some kind of redemption for those who lost friends and loved ones in the Civil War, for those who, you know, had given up that this thing would not happen. And I think it may open the eyes of the Liberian government, hopefully, that they too will begin to look at the issue of impunity and begin to explore aggressively the issue of the war crimes code for Liberia.
Rodney, thank you very much again. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you, James.
That was Rodney Sia, publisher and editor of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper. You're speaking with us from Bellinzona, Switzerland. Kenya university students are protesting the move by government to allow universities to increase tuition for public schools by threefold, from $160 to $480 per year. Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
The proposed tuition hike will come into effect in January 2021. The Treasury says the government is not able to fully fund the broke public institutions, which means the parents will now shoulder the burden. The universities have accumulated a debt of up to $37 million in statutory deductions. University students took to the street yesterday, Thursday, calling on the government to rescind the decision, which involves a reduction in the loan amount they receive from the Higher Education Loans Board. Eddie Mwendwa is the chairperson for University of Nairobi Students Association.
Comrades, power!
Power!
Comrades, power!
Power!
We give the government 7 days to go back to the drawing board, review these recommendations, and advisably do away with them. We will not take any attempt to increase fees for students or lower the help provisions. Any action against comrades that is unjust will be fought and fought fearlessly.
Education Cabinet Secretary Professor George Magoha says that there should be further discussions on the proposal and the students should also be involved. He says while an increase in fees may be necessary, tripling the amount of increase is not.
The government of the Republic of Kenya does not wake up and say school fees has increased 4 times. Even though there was a discussion in Parliament, I would want to assure them that this is a COVID period. The children are ours, and I think we are a human face, and that even though the discussion started in Parliament, they shall be ongoing and they will be very consulted. And I very strongly feel, having been a university leader myself, that their input may be required. One may argue that it is true and fair and just to increase school fees over 30 years, but increasing it 4 times perhaps may require some element of debate so that there's some form of consensus.
Under the current fees subsidy policy put in place in 1989, the government pays $700 while the students pay $160. The increase is expected to burden parents who are already feeling the pain of the COVID-19 pandemic that has caused salary cuts, job losses, and slow economic growth. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Aid groups in northern Mozambique say attacks on civilians have displaced close to 400,000 people during 3 years of murky Islamist terrorism. Reporter Charles Manguiro went to Mozambique's troubled Cabo Delgado province and has this report from the regional capital, Pemba.
50-year-old Mutumba Musa says armed men showed up at his house in Musimba da Praia one October night and demanded he call his relatives. After his three brothers arrived, the man set his house on fire along with three others, he says, and then took his brothers into the forest. Musa says 3 days later, they found dismembered bodies in the forest. They could not tell which body parts belonged to which corpse, he says, so they just buried them. Islamic State group linked Islamist insurgents took over Musimboda Praia in August, one of a series of brazen attacks this year in Mozambique's northern Cabo Delgado province. Musa fled south to the provincial capital's Metuji refugee camp, becoming one of close to 400,000 people displaced by the violence since 2017. The World Food Program's representative in Cabo Delgado, Cristina Graziani, says they're assisting those in need.
The latest official count is a bit above 366,000 people displaced in Cabo Delgado, in the province, and that has obviously been an increase in the past 6 months. So WFP has adjusted its program to try to cater the emergency food needs of these people. What we are doing is we continue to plan assistance for people who are newly displaced. Our monthly food ration covers 80% of the basic food needs of a family of five.
As the insurgency and its victims expand, concerns about displaced are growing. Mozambique Center for Public Integrity promotes democracy and human rights. The SIPS Borjish Namire says the government needs to do more for displaced civilians in Cabo Delgado. Charles Banguiro, Pemba, Mozambique.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the news that the second leg qualifying matches of the first preliminary round of the 2020-2021 Total Cup Champions League will take place this weekend. The aggregate winners from this weekend's qualifying round will get into the second preliminary round to join title holders Al Ahly of Egypt, AS Vita Club of DR Congo, Club Desportivo Juan de Agosto of Angola, Esperance of Tunisia, Horoya AC of Guinea, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa, Raja Club Athletic of Morocco, TP Mazembe of DR Congo, Wydad Athletic Club of Morocco, and Zamalek of Egypt. In athletics, Kenya's head of the Athletics Integrity Unit, Adia Kumar, says transparency and fairness is key in sports. He was speaking while addressing young athletes from Kenya's North Rift region at a seminar organized for under 20 athletes in the country. The seminar was organized by the Athletics Kenya and the Athletics Integrity Unit to sensitize the athletes over the importance of practicing clean sports.
We are grooming a new generation of athletes that is to take over from the old athletes who are retiring now. And they are being part of making them people of honor, people of integrity. We have imparted this kind of a seminar such that they can grow up knowing all the vices and grow up to be who they should be.
In rugby news, Kenya Rugby Union will be one of the beneficiaries of the Rugby African grant of $324,000 to kickstart activities in the 2021 season. KRU is among the 11 federations set to receive the funds, with Namibia, Uganda, Tunisia, Zimbabwe, Algeria, Zambia, Madagascar, Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal, Ghana, who are all eligible. Rugby Africa President Khalid Babu said the funds clearly illustrates Rugby Africa's support for its union, describing the unions as going through extraordinary challenges this year, hence the financial support to keep this much-loved sport alive in Africa. In basketball news, reigning champions Mali registered a 64-36 victory over host Egypt in the opening game of the FIBA Under-18 Women's African Championship on Thursday at the Cairo Stadium. Staying with basketball news, this time around in the United States, where Nigerians made history in the NBA draft pick this week for the 2020-2021 season. 8 players of Nigerian heritage were selected in the 2020 NBA draft, with 2 of them making the top 10 pick. The 8 players are of Nigerian heritage, with 2 of them born in Nigeria, while the other 6 are related to Nigeria by their parents. The reigning most valuable player of the NBA is Giannis Antetokounmpo of the Milwaukee Bucks, a son of immigrant Nigerian parents from Greece. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, December 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.